Thank you. Yes, so the only question that was asked already was how long the talk will be, and I just have to say I don't know. I usually teach this part and that to my students in about 6 hours, and that's a longer talk now, but you're not students, and we can't stop anywhere here.
After lunch.
Exactly, we can then continue. Your interesting talk, please, or just leave until then.
Have a discussion of where to start.
Yeah, I think for the discussion of where to start is in order to explain the loop algorithm, I first have to explain the classical cluster methods. Because without that, you can't really understand it. So I have to start easy. But I want to quickly show first what we can do now, what we couldn't do before without these methods. And that is that before 1994 or so, the biggest system studied by Imad and co-workers on a big vector machine using many months of CPU time were 200 spins at a temperature of 0.1. A year later, we did 20,000 spins at a temperature that was 20 times lower. So we can do systems now that are about 1,000 times bigger than before. The record in system size is Sandvik, who this year did 16 million spins in a 3D cubic big lattice. So, and the reason why we need these methods is that if we want to study the critical properties, phase transitions, then we need to reach the scaling regime that did this go to large core relation length, and for that we need large lattices. And that's possible now with these methods. I will just show three short examples, realistic ones, all of them. But we have done much more. We've worked also on some bosons, on supersolids, on magnetic phases, pneumatics, SUN models. And we start working on quantum spin glasses, dissipation, and trapped bosons in atomic condensate. I could give many talks on that, but I just want to mention a few realistic results for materials. That is the calculation now that is 5 years old on a 2D square lattice Heisenberg model for a cuprate or a nickelite. And there were two theories, essentially. You can study that by field theory and RG. And there, the correlation length at low temperatures can be calculated exactly. And that is due to Hass and Fratz and Niedermeyer. And this is this blue line on the plot of Xi versus the inverse temperature. And the measurements on a nickel oxide are these red dots. And here, since we know the J value, we know the velocity C, we know the lattice spacing A, we know the stiffness OS, so there's no free parameter. And we have a difference of a factor of 2 to 3 between theory and the experiment. So the question is the Heisenberg model a realistic model for that? The theoretician said probably the Heisenberg model is not the realistic model, while the experimental people said, no, we are right, but the theory is wrong. So then Kukoli had a semi-classical treatment, where he said that the main effect of the quantum fluctuation is to renormalize the temperature. And that gives this green line here, which fits perfectly. So here, the answer is rather it looks semi-classical, and that is confirmed by our black dots, which are Monte Carlo results on a spin one model. And so the spin one Heisenberg model fits rather well, but the low temperature RG treatment is not valid for these spin one materials. For cuprates, it looks different, spin one half. It fits rather nicely, while the same method, the classical treatment there does not work. We here went up to a xi of about 130, which needed a lattice of 1,000 times 1,000 spins, and that's possible with these new methods.
So field theory works for copper, but not for nickel?
Field theory works. The quantum effects are relevant only at very low temperature when the quantum effects become important. For nickel, which is spin 1, which is more classical, you need to much lower temperature, so much larger xi before you can see that. But then nickel orders in 3D, these nickel oxides order. It's between spin being large and small. The smaller the spin, the stronger the effect of the quantum fluctuations.
And can you say what PQSCH is?
Pure quantum self-consistent harmonic approximation. Right. So this shows that the theories like RG or some semi-classical treatment are nice once you know in which regions to apply it. But we need the numerics to really show realistically where they are valid in order to keep with the workshop topic. Then also we can use that to fit measurements of materials like some spin ladders, where the spins on the rung form a singlet, essentially, and that has a spin gap, which we see in a calculation of the spin ladder model here. There's a sharp drop in the uniform susceptibility as a function of temperature. We can now not only show that a ladder has such a spin gap, but we can also play with the couplings at some impurity terms from impurity, some Curie terms, and make a perfect fit from which we can extract some coupling links, and that we can then compare to LDA plus U treatments or other approaches. These loop methods, which were used for that, they work only as long as there is no magnetic field, or when we have bosons only at half filling. Since 2 years, that has been relaxed, and we now can do the methods also when doping boson systems and get the phase diagrams there. One big question in bosons was, is there a phase that is called a supersolid phase that is at the same time superfluid and a solid phase? So we start from half filling, so such a checkerboard solid, and we dope that. Will these holes become superfluid while the order remains or not? And first, results 6 years ago using local updates by some groups showed that on a 6x6 lattice or 8x8, there was indeed a super solid phase. What we show, it's not a super solid, but we have a first order transition. What they thought to be a super solid is actually phase separation only. But we could show that only because we can now go to systems that are 100 times 100 sites big, so much bigger, and then we can see that. So here we see then that at low temperatures, the phase transition between the solid and the superfluid is first order, at high temperature, second order. There are two tricritical points in this region here. And there is a small region here close to these points where both when you heat the solid or when you cool it, it will melt in both directions. So when you heat the superfluid, it will turn into a normal fluid, then it will freeze out and then melt again. That's like in helium 3 or 4 films that should also appear there.
So I just make sure I understand. So the thick line
is first order transition.
It ends up into a second
order. Here, yes, exactly, and the
second order line.
Line, yes, and the KT line of the superfluid just meets up with the first order line. Somewhere here.
At some special point.
At some exactly not
and
special
second
point.
Second order lines. I mean, you know the exponents and the critical behavior.
Yes, that's Ising.
So there's no coexistence of superfluidity.
There's no coexistence of superfluidity. There is a phase separation, but no supersolid phase. Once we extend this by longer range couplings, then we get stripe phases. And when we dope them, then there is coexistence in the doped stripes that we have with the next nearest neighbor repulsion in addition.
So what happens to the jump now as you move along that line, the positive jump, as you go along that line?
As we go along this line, the jump goes with the TC. It's just 2 over pi times TC.
Okay, but what happens? So there's a finite jump.
And then here there's a finite jump going down. And when we cross down here, then there's a jump which is much bigger than what we would expect from a KT transition. That's why it's a first order transition.
But if I go near that line and I go up?
Yeah.
Right? So it always stays finite?
It always stays finite, yes. This does not go down here. Yes, that's how we found that this meets up here, because the jump always stays finite and big.
So at this point where the Kosterlitz-Taurus line and the first order line meet, the Kosterlitz-Taurus jump is maximum.
So it's maximum at the highest TC, of course.
It's maximum at the highest TC, I see. So it reduces.
Yeah. It is the universal and just multiple of the temperature. Since the mass is fixed for the bosons.
You have some intuitive explanation for this re-entrant behavior?
Yes, it's entropy. Because in this solid, when we dope it, we have some vacancies. And we are here the fixed chemical potential. That means the higher we go in temperature, the more vacancies we get. Now, these vacancies can tunnel from one side to the other, but they have a small matrix element for tunneling. So at these temperatures will be much higher than the bandwidth of this hopping, so they are essentially free vacancies and have a high entropy. While the liquid here is very close to a superfluid and has already lost much of its entropy, that's why this can happen here. But that needs to be measured. We had no way of measuring entropy until July. That's the von Landau method, which we haven't used for that yet because it's too new. Okay, so now we had that. How do we do these the simulations? And we do them by Monte Carlo, since we can't sample all configurations exactly. So the standard ways, we just pick a configuration C with the right Boltzmann weight, and then the average can be of a quantity A can be approximated by the mean of the value A measured at those samples which are picked randomly with the right probability, and they will have a statistical error, which goes away as 1 over the square root of the number of samples. There's only one problem here, namely you have to be able to pick a configuration with the correct probability. In some simple problems, one can do that. Here we can't, and the main problem is because we don't know the partition function C. We just don't know that, so we can't really pick something with the right probability. The solution to that will next year turn 50 years. And that's the metropolis method. Instead of just picking randomly a configuration, I build a Markov chain process where I start from some configuration and randomly change it a bit. And I define the transition rate in such a way that asymptotically for long times, I will reach the desired distribution. In order to get the correct distribution here, we need to have two conditions on the transition probabilities. The first one is the process must be ergodic, which means it must be possible to reach any configuration from any other in a finite amount of time. The second is that these rates have to fulfill detailed balance, meaning the probability of going from some configuration X to a configuration Y divided by the probability of going from Y back to X has to be the same as the ratio of the probabilities of the states Y and X. So far that's standard, and I think everybody knows that. The solution to this detailed balance equation by the metropolis was to take the minimum of 1 and the ratio of Py divided by Px. In order to calculate this ratio, I just need the energy differences, and I don't need the part the partition function, which was that normalization factor that we didn't know. So here we just need to know how does it change when we, how does the energy change when we slightly change our configuration. And in a spin model, let's say in icing spins, we can simply flip one spin from up to down, then calculate how the energy changes and use this as the acceptance rate. But this method has a problem. And the problem is that now we have to calculate the errors in a different way. While before I said that when we pick the configurations randomly, the error will just be the square root of the variance of a quantity divided by the number of samples. Now in this Markov chain process, since the consecutive samples are correlated, so the error is not that simple equation, but when we calculate the error as the square root of the expectation value of the square of the deviation of the mean from the expectation value, then we find it's the variance of the quantity divided by the number of sample points times a factor, which is 1 plus 2 times the autocorrelation time. So the errors do get larger. And we have to essentially use here not the number of samples m, but the number of the independent samples, which is m divided by 1 plus 2 times tau. At the phase transition, the problem now is that this tau diverges. Then our errors diverge. And for the local updates, the divergence goes with the square of the system size. So if we want to study a 100 cubed system, it's a factor of 10,000 slower. And that might be too slow. I can show that for the 2D icing model, this nice applet that many of you know already. We start from just all spins up, all these spins are now white, that means up, and some fluctuate to black, to down spins. That's a temperature of 1/2 of TC. when we go to high temperatures, we'll just disorder completely. And the method works great also here. Now let's go close to the phase transition, close to TC. We first see that we start forming larger domains. Like here they grow. We can wait a bit. And now the problem is that the physical domains have this size here. They are bigger than just a single spin. And they want to change them by randomly flipping single spins. That just will not be effective, since that's a random walk process for these single spins. They take a long time to flip such big clusters of spins. What we can now do is we can say, OK, the physical domain size is xi. It's that big now. So let's try to flip a big cluster. The straightforward way for that would be to say, OK, let's just pick a cluster, maybe this here, and let's flip it. But now you see that the cluster, if it's this size here, we cross through here, and we will introduce the main wall here and also here. So the acceptance rate for such a cluster will be very low, since it costs lots of energy. That's not the right way to go. Local updates, as you see, are also far too slow. They just don't change this. What we need is now a clever way of constructing a cluster, not just randomly, but finding a big cluster that you want to flip in such a way that the acceptance rate will be 1. You want to build a big cluster of that size, and know once we build it, it will be accepted. We can flip it. That is the main trick behind these cluster methods. And I just want to show quickly how well they work. These red spots are the clusters. We flip them here. That's much faster than these local updates we had before, which just don't change anything. So now we have to be clever and find a good way of constructing these clusters. And they will first show that for the Ising model, and then later for the quantum systems. So what happens when we flip one spin? We look at its neighbors. If the neighbor was anti-parallel in this ferromagnetic Ising model, and we want to flip it to be parallel, that's good, because that gains energy, and we always want to do that. The problem is only if we want to flip a spin, and one of these spins was aligned. Because if we now flip just this spin here, then we lose energy. Now, the local update methods say, OK, we now calculate what is the acceptance probability for flipping that spin. And if that's too low, then we just don't flip it. In the cluster algorithm, we think different. What we say is we start from this spin here. And let's look at this neighbor. The neighbor is aligned. So what is the probability that I will change this spin to be anti-parallel to the neighbor? And that is the probability of e to the minus 2 beta times j, because they lose energy 2 times j. But now, instead of rejecting the flip of the spin completely, if I don't want, I just say, OK, if I don't want to flip this spin against the other, I just have to flip the other spin as well. So I look at one spin. I look at all the neighbors. I ask, do I want to flip this spin against my neighbor? If I do, then it's fine. Then I can just flip it. If I don't want to, then I say, OK, like these three spins here, they don't want to be flipped against me. So I just say, I will also flip these three other spins. That way, I build a cluster recursively.
And this is just the Wolf algorithm? Or?
That's the Wolf algorithm, yes. You can then build also many clusters. That will be the Swenson Wang method. I'll come to that. So this is the main point here. That if I don't want to flip this cluster against that, I just also flip the other. But this requires that the state with all spins down and all spins up has the same energy. That's where the magnetic field will be a problem. Good, so I start from one spin. I ask the neighbors, and with if they are aligned, then with probability 1 minus e to the minus 2 beta j, I will just also add them to the cluster and then check its neighbors and so on. And that builds this cluster. And that works well. Now, how do we generalize that? That's for the Ising model. The Heisenberg model is done by saying, OK, I just take one component and flip just that and use the same trick there. But then for the Potts model, it's a bit harder. For clock models, it will be even harder. Then for quantum spins, it's not really obvious. And what helps there is the reformulation of this method, where you make it a bit more formal. What we have when we build these clusters, what we do is we say we just add, we build this cluster. So we add a graph on top of our spins. We draw lines between those spins that we want to flip together as one cluster. So we go from a phase space of just the configurations to a phase space of the configurations with some graphs. So we add a graph, and all the spins which are connected by lines of my graph will then have to be flipped together in the Ising model case. So I had the partition function, which I wrote as a sum over all the configuration of the weight of a configuration. And I write that now as a sum over all configurations and graph of a combined weight of the configuration and the graph, where the weight of the configuration has to be just the sum over all the graphs, the weight of the configuration and the graph.
So these graphs are forests or something?
They are?
Forests? I mean, if I think of a cluster, it suffices to take a tree to say that spins belong to the same cluster. So is a collection of trees this graph?
You can view that as a. No, it's just disconnected, the graph of my.
Right, you can have loops.
Yes, there can be loops in it.
Do you need loops?
No, there can be loops. Yeah. We don't need loops, but there can be loops.
So yeah. When you say that the graph G is allowed for C, it means that I take configuration C and I can draw all graphs such that in a given part of the graph all the spins are aligned. A given
I'll come to that now. So, and what I want next, I don't want the graph weight to depend on the configuration. That will be essential. So I want to write this weight of configuration, the graph, that it is just the graph weight if in this configuration we can have the graph. And in the Ising model, that will mean that then if two spins are aligned, we are allowed to draw a line between them. So that's a connected graph, kind of. If they are not aligned, we are not allowed to draw that, yes.
Are these graphs on the dual lattice or on the original lattice?
Live on the original lattice. So we had these spins here. Now we say I want to flip these spins together, and I add a graph here and here.
Could you switch on? Sorry.
I should use another color. I have an upspin, an upspin, and maybe an upspin, and an upspin, and a downspin, and upspin, and I now want to say I want to have a graph connecting these here. That will be then my cluster.
Okay.
So it suffices to take unions of trees.
But it can look like this. Then it's no longer a tree.
It can look, but is it necessary to
In this formulation, it is necessary to also allow these. Since what I will do is I will write now the since the weight of the total configuration, I can write as a product over all my bonds, the bond weights. And I want to, in the same way, write the weight of a graph as a product of all the graphs on a local bond. So I view it locally and look just at a single bond and fulfill detailed balance locally. That will build graphs that just contain loops. But I'll come to the example on the next slide. Now what we do is we start from a configuration like our spins here. So we no longer have the light now. Yes. Then we add in some way a graph to it. Well, for each of these bonds, we pick a graph type. We'll have two here. Can be open or closed, connected or not connected. We'll pick one depending on the local probability. Once we have that, we just throw away the configuration and forget about it. Now we've mapped it actually to a graph representation. And we can write the partition function of the IC model also as a sum over the all possible graphs. What we do next is we pick just any other configuration that is compatible with this graph. Then we throw away the graph.
Sorry, what is compatible?
You have to, in the Ising model, those which are connected by a graph, they have to be the same spin direction.
Right.
Since here I want to go from a configuration C I plus one, CI to CI plus one. And the transition rate of going from here to there versus the backward path for the detailed balance has to be the same as the probability of having the configuration I plus one divided by the configuration I. Now that in both cases we have to have the same graph, since we have this combined picture of a configuration and a graph, we know that the probabilities of these, if both are non-zero, so if this delta is 1 in both cases, they will be the same. So they will have the same probability, and they can just flip the cluster. But it means that I can go to any new configuration as long as this function delta of C and G, which tells me if the graph is allowed, is 1. In the Ising model, that will be that if two spins are connected, they have to be aligned. They can go to any new configuration that where all the spins in the cluster remain parallel. So the example for the Ising model is I take two types of local graphs. It can be connected or disconnected. And I need to write the weight of the configuration as sum of all the graphs, this delta of C and G times V of G. How do I find a solution here? First, I say the open graph, which has no constraint, that should be allowed for all configurations. So I put the one here in this delta. Now this here, the anti-parallel spins, that has the smaller weight, namely e to the minus beta j. So let me pick the graph weight here as e to the minus beta j. Then this case is okay. The case where the spins are parallel, the weight is bigger. And now I just say in this case, we can also add the connected graph. That graph will have a weight of e to the beta j minus e to the minus beta j, so that the sum gives me the correct probability. Now, what does it mean in this update? The first step is I pick a graph, meaning if the spins are not aligned, I have to pick the open one. There's nothing to be done. If they were parallel, then I've got two choices, connected or disconnected. The probability for having the connection is just e to the beta j minus e to the minus beta j divided by the total weight, and that's the same factor as before, 1 minus the exponential of minus 2 beta j. Next, I throw away the configuration, but keep this graph, and now go to a new configuration. But I keep the graph, meaning wherever there's a connection, the spins have to be either both up or both down. So the formal problem becomes one of solving this set of equations, finding a decomposition of the weights into graph weights. Then all the spins that are connecting the graph have to be flipped together. These are the clusters.
But you just define the weights for length, for just a small
I just
graph.
Define it locally, yes, because I can decompose the weighting to a product of the local bonds. And now this spin has to be flipped with this and that. So these form clusters. These local graph segments will then form the big clusters.
Should you just separate it in all subclusters, or you just separate it into the smaller subcluster? I mean, the bond. Right. What do you do? I mean, you could decompose the graph into very different graphs, each of which has.
Yeah. I look at each bond separately. Here.
Okay.
And now. This will be a disconnected graph. What I must do next, I need to find the connected components, these clusters, and each of them can be flipped in the dependently. And this will then be the Swenson-Wang method. So you can build either just one cluster, which you grow from one spin, as I showed before, or you can look at each bond and find all the clusters and then flip each one with probability 1/2.
Sorry, I didn't understand. I mean, in the Wolf algorithm, you just pick one single spin and
yeah.
grow from there.
I can grow a single cluster.
Right. And then you check the cluster.
Right.
In the Swenson-Wang, you just enumerate all the clusters.
I take my whole system, have all my bonds, and find some clusters like here and here and here and here.
Now, what do you do?
Oh, one can show that the Wolf algorithm, which starts from a single spin like here and grows a cluster recursively, that picks a large cluster with a larger probability.
Sure.
And it can be shown that in three dimensions and higher, it is actually more efficient. It scales better.
I see.
The Swenson-Wang method, which builds all the clusters, parallelizes better.
Right.
So it's a trade-off.
Good. I understand Wolf. I understand Spencer.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know what is different, I mean, from your stuff now here. I mean, that's
it. Yeah. This is just the formal way that can be extended then to the quantum systems. So let's go to the quantum systems. The big problem is we don't have the eigenvalues for the energies, because if we had them, it would all be solved. So we need something else. We need to write this as some classical model. And so as a sum over some classical configurations of the probability of this classical one, the problem that can appear is the sign problem if some of these configurations get negative, and I'll shortly talk about that also. But first, what are the two approaches that we can use to represent a quantum system as a classical model? The first is standard path integrals, where what we do is we do a perturbation theory in imaginary time. So we split our Hamiltonian into the diagonal part H0 and some interaction term V. Let's say the SC terms in H0 and the exchange terms in V. And then we write the trace of e to the minus beta H as the trace of e to the minus beta H0 times the time order, the exponential of the integral of 0 to beta d tau V of tau, which is nothing but a Taylor series. And each of these integrals here is of a terms that have a representation in terms of word lines, like a Feynman diagram, but in real space and in imaginary time here. So we do the trace, which is the sum over all the initial states here, like the pink might be an upspin, the green a downspin, so it's up, down, up, down. Now, this is one of the terms that contribute here to the one, where there's no extra operator, and this goes from zero to beta. Then we've got the terms in first order, which is sometime tau have some exchange term v here, like this. But in this case, the trace does not close, so this does not contribute. We're glad in this case, because this comes in with a negative sign, and that would lead to the sign problem. The first term that can be done then is the second order one, where it hops here and back. And now we do a sampling over all the possible configurations of up to a million or more such operators, and we sample that by the Monte Carlo. We can use local updates, which will again be slow, or the cluster updates, which will be faster. This is a nice way of writing it. It is. But it has one problem, namely these times will be computationally expensive in treating them. There is a second method, the SSE method, which replaces these times by an integer index, which will be easier to deal with. In this SSE method, we don't write it as a path integral, but just as a high temperature series expansion, so as a Taylor series in the inverse temperature, which is then further write as a sum over all the orders, a sum over the trace, as a sum over all the initial states, the basis states. And h to the n, we decompose further. We write the Hamiltonian as a sum over all the bond terms, all the local hoppings, or the Ising terms, exchange terms. And then h to the n will just be a sum over all the possible combinations of n such bond terms multiplied.
But how are you going to compute correlation functions in this approach?
The way we calculate correlation function is that we just measure the equal time one. We have the equal time one. We just insert them in the trace here. The imaginary time one. What we have to do is we have to reintroduce times, because we can map this back to the path integrals, since this SSE is actually nothing but the path integral representation we had here, where we have taken the integral over all times but kept the order of the operators. So we can now reintroduce times artificially, and then the separation in the index maps to the time separation with some convolution here with a probability function for having that time at that distance in the operators.
Anyway, right? You do slices anyway, so you would have an index also, right?
Time slices?
Yeah.
No.
I see.
Why? This is an integral. We do these path integrals in continuous time. Why should we introduce a discrete time?
Okay.
Yeah.
So how do you do numerically?
Numerically, how do we do the integral from 0 to 1 over f of x? You just pick random points. You just sample it.
Sample is
right.
Yeah.
So if you discretize, it's
pick up not random points.
Right, exactly.
It's against.
You take random points, and that's faster. Of course, that works only if you can write the path integral if it's well defined in continuous time. In this case, where we have discrete space points, it is well defined and there's no problem. We tried that once in K-space, continuous space. Then we get problems with the divergences and all the usual problems. But
you mean the trajectories are basically Brownian, right? That's what you mean.
No. What happens there even is for short enough times, we can go to arbitrarily high energies. So in K-space, it just jumps around to high, yes. So in real space, it's Brownian, right? And that we just can't model.
But to determine the weights, you have to introduce a complete set of states, right? To get
yes.
analytic expressions of weights.
Right, exactly.
And for
we have that.
Complicated models, it gets sort of. Are the weights simple or?
In a spin model, a TJ model, a Hubbard model, they are simple.
Okay.
So you need to know them. So here. The advantage is we just have this index, and that's easier to treat. But the advantage of the path integrals was that we could separate and solve some parts exactly. And that we lose in the SSE formulation. So when the diagonal terms are large and dominant, then you should use the path integrals. If they are small, then you should better use SSE. Okay, a few more details. Again, on the 1D Heisenberg model. The first problem is that we had this product over terms of minus h because it was e to the minus beta h. In order for this configuration to have positive weight, we need that the matrix elements of minus h are all positive. There is no problem for the diagonal part that we just add some offset here with from quad of j, and it will be 0 if spins are parallel, and j over 2 if spins are anti-parallel. The off-diagonal term is positive here, so if minus h it will be negative. We can solve that if the lattice is bipartite by having gauge transformation of Si plus and Si minus on one of the sublattices by changing the sign there. So that an antiferromagnet on a bipartite lattice is no problem. When the lattice is no longer bipartite, there will be the sign problem, or when it's fermions. Next, we do one more step because this string of operators from 1 to n changes in size. But that's not nice for the program, so we fix it to a finite length L. Instead of running the sum from 0 to infinity, we fix the size of the operator string to lambda, and lambda is large enough. And then the orders n are now simulated by inserting extra unit operators in this operator string. We can place them at the lambda minus n positions and have to correct for that factor. So now we have this string of lambda operators where most are ones, and then we replace them by some hopping terms or Ising terms for the updates. But a short excursion, what happens when the probabilities can't all be chosen positive? When some of them are negative, then we have the sign problem. which occurs since we want to interpret these PIs as probabilities, and they have to be positive. What we do then is we rewrite that by sampling, not with P, but with the absolute here, with the value of P, and by moving the sign into the measurement. And what we then get is the expectation value of the quantity multiplied by the sign, measured with respect to the absolute value of P, divided by the expectation value of the sign. Now this sign here is then nothing but the ratio of the partition functions of the original problem and the one where I ignore the signs. And since the free energy is the logarithm of the partition function and it is extensive, the sign is then the exponential of the ratio of the exponential of the difference of the free energies, and that goes like e to the minus a constant times the inverse temperature times the number of sites in the system. So this sign problem makes the error increase exponentially. For fermions, it is just that you just want to ignore the Fermi sign. So you sample for hardcore bosons and measure for the fermions, and that will just not be a good sampling. For spins, you sample for the ferromagnet and want to measure a spin glass, and that also will not work. And so in general, we found one problem where we could show that solving the sign problem there would solve all the NP complete problems. And this is rather unlikely. We think that there is no general solution to the sign problem. But in some special cases, for some special models, hopefully for the Hubbard model, we might still be able to find a solution, although it looks more unlikely with this.
Well, you have to define a solution. I mean, if your coefficient is, I mean, you know, 1 over 10,000, I mean, it's still okay.
Can you say precisely what you mean by solve the sign problem?
A solution to the sign problem for us is I give you a model here,
yes,
which has a sign problem, so where the error scales exponentially with the inverse temperature and the number of sites. A solution to the sign problem is any mapping to another problem that is no longer exponential. This case polynomially in the system size and inverse temperature.
Yeah, what I'm saying is, I mean, for
mapping of the model or mapping of the algorithm?
Yeah, right. It's an algorithm dependent question, right?
Yes.
Right. And my point is, I mean, you don't even need that. I mean, you would only need to reduce this number by a large factor, I mean, because then the sign problem only becomes relevant at very, very low temperature.
Okay.
So you don't need a complete solution of the problem.
You just need to reduce this factor here by a factor of 1,000,000. That wouldn't touch it. No, so just
it's not impossible. No. But, I mean, it's very
any
impossible.
Way of mapping this problem to any other problem, so we have found a problem. But if we ignore the sign, we can solve it immediately, linear time. But since we have the sign, it is probably exponential. But the solution of this model, if you find the ground state of this Hamiltonian, that will in a time that is not exponential in the size, would then also give you the solution for all the NP complete problems.
Can you briefly say what the model is?
The model there are some classical spin glasses that are shown to be NP complete. We take the spins as quantum spins as sigma x. Then it's just exchange terms.
I mean, so it's just JIJ, it's just the XY quantum spin glass.
No, XX quantum spin glass.
I don't understand. If there is only X component, it's not quantum.
We just write it. Sigma X, sigma IX, sigma JX, and the JIJ in front of it.
That's the Ising model.
That's the Ising model. But now let's view it as a quantum problem.
Okay. It's not.
Oh, why not? Spin one halves.
It has no dynamics.
It has no dynamics. It's an Ising model.
Well,
it's the Ising spin glass.
Yes.
So it is
we take sigma x as operators. Use this mapping to two path integrals,
pretending
it's quantum. Then this will just be a random sign for the exchange, which will give me a sign problem. If I ignore that, I've got the ferromagnet, and it's easy to solve. So ignoring the sign samples the ferromagnet, but I actually want to sample the Ising spin glass, and that is just a bad idea. That's what the sign problem is about.
In two dimensions,
it's not 2D. It's
imagine it's not NP, this problem,
no.
Right?
It's an infinite D, the Ising spin glass that we have. And that is NP complete.
Yes.
We can map it to that problem, which has a sign problem.
Mm.
If you now had a general way of mapping a sign problem away, you had solved the NP complete problems.
But let me ask a question. I mean, if you solve this same model, okay,
yes,
in two dimensions, pretending it's quantum, you also get a sign problem.
Right. So there are some sign problems that are not NP.
And that's right. And
yes.
That's what I mean. Because we have Chinese Postman algorithms,
right,
for example.
Yes, exactly.
Very well.
In that case, you have a sign problem where you are artificially made it with exponential.
Right, so you can make it exponential.
Yes, so some sign problems you can solve. But we've shown one where we say that solving that sign problem solves all the NP complete problems in polynomial time.
But it doesn't mean that all problems that have sign problems.
No,
are
exactly.
Okay, good.
But any general solution, like Karloff saying he can solve the sign problem, mm-hmm, I just ask him, yes, apply it to this model. So it's not hopeless, but from the Meron method, we learned that there are some models where we can solve it. All those models turned out to be trivial. Reducing this pre-factor here by a factor of 1 million, that would also earn you lots of money. So we have not shown that the fermion sign problem for the Hubbard model is exponential. We just show that if you think of any general way of tackling the sign problem, it will not work.
Sure.
It has to be model specific. Okay, so now let's return to these updates and the easiest is in the SSE model, the representation where we have this operator string. And let's look at one example here, where we've got three operators, one at the index 1, which is an SCSC 1, an exchange at index 2, and an exchange at index 4 again. So this is three operators, and we just store that in a string of length 5. And now for the updates, we just replace such a unit operator by some Ising term by the diagonal operator HID. And the probability for that can be found from going back just to the representation here. There's a factor of beta coming in. I change the N here, and I have one more matrix element of this HI. And it's so the update probability here will just be the beta, then a factor of the number of bonds that this is, how many I's I can pick here, the matrix element, and the factor of L minus N. For removing, it's just the inverse. And they use a Metropolis update. For path integrals, the probability of the insertion is just h times d tau. That's a Poisson process, like radioactive decay, and I simply calculate some time at which I want to insert this operator. These updates are nice and can remove and insert the diagonal operators, but they also need to insert off-diagonal ones. The simplest way is local, like I take a word line and deform it. That works in discrete time, that also works in continuous time. So we don't need any discrete time here. There are two problems. The first one, it is not ergodic, since that way I can't change the number of spins or of particles, I can't change the winding numbers. The second problem is local updates, again here, suffer from critical slowing down. The solution is again the cluster algorithms. And then we quickly show how they look like here, and then explain how they work. It's again the same as in the case of the Ising model. I've got my word lines here. Instead of the spins, green is down spins and black might be the up spins. And that's the configuration now with no operator inserted. So n equal to 0. Now I just do some of these loop cluster updates, and it changes the word lines. Again, nicely and quickly. In the biggest systems that was done by Imada or by Sandvik before the cluster updates were 200 spins, the inverse temperature of 10. They could even go to 20 sometimes. Let's do that. So I can just do that here on my laptop. Much better than they could do on the big vector machines of those times. But of course, this laptop is faster than those vector CPUs. In addition. But the main progress was the algorithms and not the faster machines. So how do we do the cluster algorithms here? The first observation is that now when we do an update, we can't just flip a single spin because we have to keep the word lines continuous. We're not allowed to break the word line, so all the changes must be closed loops along which we flip spins. Like such a loop here, if we flip all the spins here, then we get this configuration. So at each local operator that we have, which might have all the spins up or down, or one down and one up or one down, or the exchange process, when we flip spins here, we always have to flip two spins. In this case, we can flip these two spins, or these two, or all four. Here we can flip these two spins, or these two spins, or all four, but we can't flip these two spins, because that would break the spin conservation. So we again introduce some graphs which connect spins, and the spins which are connected by a line will have to be flipped together. Can be horizontal, it can be vertical, it can be diagonal, or it can be all four spins. These are the four possible local graphs on each operator. Now we have to again solve this decomposition of the weight of a configuration into graph weights and this delta function. For the configuration, we can have one upspin and one downspin. That has a matrix element of JC over 2. The two upspins or two downspins have 0, since we shift the energy 0, and that's of the matrix element of minus H. And the exchange term has a JXY over 2. Let's start from this configuration here. Here, the weight must be 0, so it's simple, and we just have all these deltas here 0. So we will just never have two spins which are parallel and an operator in between. Next, we consider this configuration here. And or let's start from this one here and look which ones are possible. You see, if I do the horizontal, did I do this correct? Okay, so here I made a mistake. The one should be over here, actually. Okay, so we check which ones are possible, and we start again with the simplest case and look at the smallest weight. And that's an if that's okay. I've done this table incorrect. Let me just fix it. The other here. There's one. No. Okay. Does it work out now? No. Okay, let me think it over. The JC is there.
So what
does
the color means actually?
The colors. Of the spins, up spins are red and down spins
so
are.
Why are the two green up?
Two greens are up?
Yeah.
Oh. They should be down. Sorry, yeah. Okay, yes, that's a new slide that I just made yesterday. Okay, so we look at the an XY like anti ferromagnet, so the JXY is bigger than the JC, and let's start with this JC term. And we'll take one graph and assign to that JC over 2. And that has to be possible here. So which graphs are possible in this case? This the horizontal one means we flip these two spins, or these two, and that takes us to this configuration down here. That is possible. This graph here means we flip these two spins, or these two, and that would take us to two down spins flipping to two up spins or back, and that is not possible in the Heisenberg model. So that has to be zero. Flipping all four spins is always possible, but we should avoid that because that just freezes out our cluster. And the vertical ones are possible. We can also just flip these two or these two, but that will not be needed here. So we just set these two zero, and that set this here to one. So in this configuration, where there's an upspin next to a downspin, we always use this horizontal graph. That has probability JC over 2. For the exchange term here, which now has the larger weight, simply JXY over 2, that is bigger, that we first allow this one, which maps this configuration back to that, if we flip, for example, only these two. So this gives me already JC over 2. Now we have to add something to go up to JXY over 2. That is, we introduce this second graph here with the probability of JXY minus JC over 2. Now the sum here is this value. And again, these graphs here I don't need. In the case of the ferromagnet, I move the one over here because these two are exchanged. In the case of the Ising-like models, I need this freezing graph here instead of the crossing. So for each range, for the ferromagnet, for the XY-like model, and so on, we need separate solutions to these graph equations here. Once we have that, that tells us how we build our clusters. Let's look at the simplest case of the Heisenberg model, but this will be zero. That means there we only have one type of graph, namely this one here, and all the spins have to be connected horizontally. And then if I have some whirl lines here, let's say an upspin and a downspin, and I've got one operator inserted here and one here, that means I have to flip these together, and I also have to flip them together here, so I just flip on this loop. So all these pins connected by the graph, you have to be flipped together. For the XY model, what the JC is. Zero, there, I can just use this or that or whatever. So there I then have, in this case, two choices for the updater. Either flip these two spins together or these two. And then I build my clusters of these spins and flip them. And that was one example here for the Heisenberg model. I start flipping these spins, meaning I have to flip this whole segment of the world line. Now I come here. When I flip this, I also have to flip the one here. So I flip this segment. Then I have to go here and flip this segment and so on and build the whole cluster. This works nicely as long as there's no magnetic field. Let's look at the case of a spin dimer, two spins in a magnetic field. When J, the exchange, is equal to the field and less one, so the energy of the triplet, which aligns with the field, is minus 3/4, and so is the energy of the singlet. How does the loop algorithm take me from the triplet to the singlet? It first builds a loop cluster. So we first insert the diagonal operators, which we can't because the matrix element for two spins parallel has been shifted to be zero. So we just build one cluster that flips a single spin. Now, in the cluster building, I said I want to flip them all together, so the flipped or the non-flipped configuration had to have the same probability. Thus, I could not include the field in building it. And then now I can accept this move only with a probability that is proportional to the energy I lose by flipping a spin against the field. So that it is e to the minus beta over 2, that is an exponential slowdown here. Of course, once I have that, I insert some operators here, build loops, and quickly get to this configuration. Once I'm here, if I want to go back, I first have to remove all these kinks here, so I have to lose all the exchange energy. And only then can I gain all the potential energy in the field. Thus, there's an exponential slowdown here, which is caused that I want to trade the potential energy in the field with the kinetic energy due to exchange. But I want to do that by first losing all of the potential energy, then gaining all of the kinetic. That's not good, and there's no solution for that classically. There's no classical cluster method which can do that efficiently, although the von Glander method can solve that in some sense. The idea by Prokofiev for the Worm algorithm was not to do these exchanges globally, but to do them locally. So he said, we start from a model and we add some extra artificial term which can flip a spin or add a particle or remove one. And what I then do is I use that to insert a so-called worm, so a small segment of the world lines that are flipped. There's an S minus operator here and an S plus operator here. Now that I've inserted this worm, I move the head and the tail of the worm around just in a random walk, filling here. That detailed balance at each step. So I might just move this up here. Then once I'm here, I could just jump over here and make this diagonal operator diagonal. Or I could jump and turn back. Or I can just bounce back. So I move them around, and this end moves around in the whole space. And once it meets up with the tail again, they bite each other, annihilate, the worm is closed, and we have built a loop. That works also in a magnetic field, since we simply move that around by local updates, but these local updates then form a cluster update. In the case when I don't have a bounce path, so when I never move back, then I can map this onto the loop building rules, actually, and build a loop cluster by moving around, and then it's efficient.
Are you changing the Hamiltonian, or are you changing the algorithm for solving the original Hamiltonian?
I'm changing the algorithm for solving the original one by thinking about it, that I add this term with a very tiny eta, which just allows me in local updates to insert this warm. So I can view that either that I add this source term to it, or I can view it that I simply, okay, so I add this source term, but measure only in those configurations where there's no warm present. Then have not changed the original problem. But now I have some configuration which have this warm in it, and the local updates on that allow me to update it faster.
I see.
This was done for path integrals by Prokofiev and for SSE by Sandvik. Although Sandvik doesn't call it warm, the reason is that he doesn't like the word warm algorithm because it's so slimy. I asked Prokofiev, and he said, but that's just because he likes the name of it. So he called it operator loop updates, or directed loops, or whatever.
Now, I mean, in production, I mean, are you really using, I mean, only measurements when the worms are gone? I mean, then you reduce, I mean, the amount.
Yes.
Of...
So you can view the loop building as a worm, and
right.
Once it's built and the update is done, then a measure. I can use the intermediate steps in order to measure Green's function, because I've added this operator, and at each step, also at the insertion and the removal, I fulfilled detailed balance. Now I've got a configuration which has these two extra operators in there, and I just interpret them as the measurement of my Green's function. That way, while building the worm, I can measure the time-dependent Green's function. But the diagonal measurements are done in between, after I close the worm and it's gone.
Like how do you choose, I mean, the probability for creating a worm?
There I have to fulfill detailed balance if you want to measure the Green's function. That is by having this very tiny term here. But this 8 is so small that at any time it just creates a single worm somewhere.
Okay.
And I restrict myself to the set of 0 or 1 worms. And then using this part in the Hamiltonian, I decide where to start my worm segment. And that's a tricky part, to initiate it
right.
And filling a detailed balance. You have to choose some segments, some time 1 and time 2, try to insert it there. Then you've got the matrix elements for that change. But that can be done. It's easy in SSE, it's a bit tricky in path integral since there's the H0 part, which gives you some extra weight from this segment you've changed here, and getting that in detailed balance is tricky.
So how do you know that the worm will eventually close within a reasonable number of steps?
It's a finite volume, so there's a finite probability for getting back. Of course, that is an excellent point, since when I first applied it to the Heisenberg model, then it worked well up to about 8x8, but on bigger systems, it was a minute sometimes, but sometimes it took a day to close. And what we had to do then is to throw away those worms that take too long to close. There is no problem with detailed balance. It is a problem with measuring the Green's functions. The SSE method is better. It has less trapping than the path integrals here. So now quickly, how does this actually work now? We start with our triplet and want to get that into the singlet. So we insert a worm here, a small one. Now we move that AND around up and down in a random walk. So now at each step, we do lose a little bit of potential energy in the field, but immediately we can already move and exchange, and thus again gain back the exchange energy. And so we do the trade between the potential energy and the exchange, not in one big step, that we first lose all of the potential and then gain all of the exchange, but we do that in many small steps. And that random walk will then close, and then we're done. And it works also in the case of a magnetic field. Or for bosons in a chemical potential, or for the soft core bosons where the loops don't work at all. So, when should one use which method? The path integrals have an advantage if there are large matrix elements which are diagonal, or if the action depends on the time, like when you have the dissipation or in the MFT. So then one should use the path integrals, otherwise SSE, and the loops are faster where they exist. If you can't find loops or these loop clusters, then you should use the worms. The worms work in all models. So in standard spin models, we use loops for SSE. With the dissipation, we use loops and path integrals. For a magnetic field, we use worms and SSE, or for a soft core boson Hubbard model where U is large, we use worms in path integrals.
How does this compare with the terminantal PMC?
The terminantal, these methods, the loops, when they work, they scale linearly in the number of spins.
But
say
for the Hubbard model?
While the determinantal algorithm scales with n cubed,
right,
times beta, this is n times beta, that's a factor n squared, that's good. The advantage of the determinantal method is that for the half-field Hubbard model, for example, there's a special symmetry that gets rid of the sign problem.
Right.
Then, of course, this representation is exponential, and the other is n cubed, so then you should use the determinantal method. Away from half filling, the sign problem has been compared, and it's similar. So the sign problem remains, and it is easier to get rid of that determinantal method than it's here. Then, just one last slide. We now have solved the critical slowing down at second order phase transitions by these cluster methods for classical spins or quantum spins. What we have still not solved is how to calculate the free energy or the entropy, because for that we need the partition function, which we don't have since we only have the relative probabilities. That's one problem. The second problem is in spin glasses, or for first order the transitions, there are large energy barriers that you have to tunnel through, and that's where the cluster algorithm also doesn't work. What works, there's a new method invented last year by Wang and Lander, the Wang-Lander sampling. That would take another 20 minutes maybe to explain. Should I now or after lunch? Okay. So that's what you wanted.
Should we take a break and then do it after lunch? So we take the time?
Okay.
Do it properly?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, okay, good.
So what time?
2:00.
2:00.
Okay, great.
Yes.